order. This is a meeting of the House and Senate Judiciary Committee, House and Senate Education Committees, and we have with us Chairman of the Finance. Oh, it'd be great. In fact, this does feel kind of nice. The Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Why don't you go ahead and introduce your members?
Sure. From the House, thank you. I'm Representative Keller, Judiciary in the House, and then we have Representative Ledoux, Gabrielle Ledoux, here, and Representative Bob Lynn, and I would suspect we'll be joined shortly by others.
Yeah, the session on the Senate side took a little bit longer, so we'll probably have people coming in. And so with us, we have Senator Dunleavy, Senator, my good friend, Dyson, Chair Coghill, the chair of the Education Committee is out flying around Alaska, Senator Stevens, but he agreed to help us with this. And I'm the chair of the Judiciary and will carry the proceeding of the meeting. So, yes, sir, Representative Keller.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. I want to recognize the House Chair of Education, Representative Lynn Gaddis, and member, Representative Laura Reinbold. And she would like to make a comment.
All right. And Senator Gardner is joining us as well. Thank you, Senator Gardner. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Senator. And as the chair of the House Education Committee, I'd like to introduce myself, Representative Lynn Gaddis, my vice chair, Representative Laura Reinbold, on the Education Committee, Representative Ledoux, and Representative Drummond. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Wilkowski, let's get a seat for Senator Wilkowski if you can. I have staff members with information if they so need it. Thanks for joining us today. So this is an informational meeting and a little bit unusual in many respects, taking up the time for the House and Senate Judiciary Committee. But there is a constitutional amendment put forward by way of a bill, and we had opportunity to have those who could testify before us available both in person and on phone today. So what I'd like to do is introduce a couple of the guests. We have one on the line with us. With us is Kevin Chavos, and he'll be joining us here shortly. I will go through his bio. In fact, Kevin, I'll have you kind of introduce yourself and bring your bio. No need for me to butcher it. You know, I will add new names and all kinds of things. So, but I appreciate you coming before us. We also have Dick Comer, who is going to be online. Online also, we have Dr. Patrick Wolf from the University of Arkansas, research on private school choice, together with Richard Comer from Arlington, Virginia, who will be before us. The way I intend to proceed is to bring the testifiers before the committee. We'll start with Mr. Comer, go to Kevin Chavos, we'll go to Ben. This is where I will probably butcher a name. It looks like Scafidi and Patrick Wolf. We'll go to that, and then we'll go to questions and answers. So welcome to the committee, Senator McGuire. Thanks for showing up. This is intended to be informational. So what I'd like to do is give them the opportunity to kind of present themselves, some of the ideas that they have, and then open it up for questions after they have spoken. But be aware, I don't want to dominate all the time in one area, so I may have to cut it short so that we can have everybody speak. Online, we have Dick Comer, and I will start there. So, Dick, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you very well. Is this Senator Coghill?
This is Senator Coghill. Thank you for joining us. If you wouldn't mind, I don't know if it's Richard or Dick. How do you...
I go by Dick.
All right.
And I'd be happy to sort of briefly introduce myself.
If you wouldn't mind, I think that credibility, it'd be much better given by you than me.
All right. Thank you. Well, I'm delighted to have been invited to testify again. I've actually spoken in both of the past 2 years to different committees of the legislature there about this amendment, so I'm fairly familiar with both the case law and why there's a need for a constitutional amendment in Alaska. But before I get to that, let me just mention that I'm a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. We're based in Arlington, Virginia. We are a public interest law firm, and we basically think of ourselves as sort of the lawyers for the school choice movement. Other people on the line today are friends of ours and who are much more oriented towards why school choice is good, what the research on existing programs shows, and some of the financial concerns that are associated with school choice programs. But my bailiwick in particular today is to talk about sort of the legal context and the legal environment for school choice, particularly as it relates to the proposed change to your constitution. I have been working on school choice for the past 20 years at the Institute for Justice, which is almost as long as the Institute has been in existence. And we both advise state legislatures that are considering school choice programs on sort of the legal aspects of the programs, and sometimes encourage them to create a tax credit generated scholarship, or to consider a direct scholarship provided by the state. And that advice is primarily based upon our reading of the state law precedents that have interpreted the state constitution. Assuming a program gets passed, most of them get challenged in court by the usual suspects. And then we assist in the defense, typically representing parents who want to make use of scholarships provided to them by these school choice programs. And we are currently defending five programs that have been passed in Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, Louisiana, and New Hampshire. And four of those states have a constitutional provision very similar to the one which your constitutional amendment would modify. They are called state Blaine amendments, and all of those states, with the exception of Louisiana, currently have a Blaine amendment in their constitution, which the opponents of school choice are trying to use to get a declaration that the program is unconstitutional. Louisiana used to have a Blaine Amendment similar to that which Alaska has, but it repealed it by a constitutional amendment. And I would note that so did the states of Arkansas and New Jersey. So this is not an unprecedented action to get rid of a Blaine Amendment. And there's Blaine Amendments actually have a fairly nasty history, although perhaps not so much in Alaska, as having been enacted basically to rebuff efforts of Catholics to obtain equal funding for Catholic schools. This is direct funding, by the way, and that word direct is going to be important in talking about the legal issues. This was to prevent their, rebuff their efforts to get direct funding for Catholic elementary and secondary schools, because those schools had been set up because at the time the public schools were non-denominationally Protestant in orientation. It is not the situation today, where of course the U.S. Supreme Court has taken religion out of the public schools. The religion they took out was a sort of non-sectarian Protestantism, and the public schools had been quite hostile to Catholics, which is why the Catholics, way back in the 1840s, started setting up their own schools, because the public schools were hostile to them. And in fact, efforts were made to use the public schools to proselytize Catholic school children. So these provisions, which we call state Blaine Amendments, actually have a very long history, deeply rooted in anti-Catholic bigotry. and they were imposed on all states that were trying to become, all territories that were in the process of becoming states. They were required to put point amendments in their state constitutions in order to become states. That probably does not include Alaska, because by then the public schools were pretty much, or some public schools had become fairly secular. Returning to the sort of general question of the need for a constitutional amendment in Alaska, I'd just like to first note that it's been said for a long time that the judiciary branch is the least dangerous branch of government, and that's generally very true. However, there is one thing about the judiciary branch, which is that it has the final word on what constitutional language means. It also has a role to play with statutory language. But the problem with the role of the judiciary with constitutional language is that when the Supreme Court of Alaska interprets a constitutional provision, the only recourse the people have in a democracy is to amend the Constitution to basically change the language which the court has interpreted. If, in the view of the people, either it is correctly construed but should be changed, or has been misinterpreted. Now, I would argue that what we're dealing with in Alaska is a misinterpretation of your language, that in fact the language of your Constitution was never meant to prohibit the sorts of school choice programs which it currently does in fact prohibit. And this is because it's been misinterpreted, misconstrued by the Alaska Supreme Court in a pair of cases involving school transportation and higher education tuition grants. These two cases are Matthews versus Quinton, which is quite old and prohibited transportation subsidies for private school kids in 1962, and then the Sheldon Jackson College versus State case in 1979, which quite frankly is almost baffling in terms of where it comes out on a higher education grant program that would have provided funding to students to select private or public colleges in Alaska. This is an unusual decision in that most of the Blaine amendments, to the extent that they cover higher education, have not been interpreted to preclude scholarship programs at the college and university level. But your state Supreme Court did, despite the particular language of your Blaine Amendment. And what your Blaine Amendment says, the sentence that is the problem and that is the subject of this amendment, is it says that no money shall be paid from public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. Now, the direct benefit is the problem here, because, and for any school choice programs in Alaska, because the Alaska Supreme Court has interpreted for the direct benefit of to include assistance provided to students and their families if that assistance can be used at private educational institutions. Now, obviously, direct is supposed to mean something. And in fact, this kind of language is found in other state constitutions, along with its sort of related term of indirect. Namely, some state constitutions, like that of New York State, which has a state Blaine Amendment, prohibit the direct and indirect support of religious or private institutions. Now, what's odd is that in the course of considering this provision in your current state constitution, the Constitutional Convention considered and rejected the inclusion of the word "and indirect," which clearly has to encompass some other additional sorts of aid beyond direct assistance. So what would direct assistance or direct aid to private institutions constitute? That's easy. If the state of Alaska made institutional grants to private institutions at either the elementary and secondary or post-secondary level, those would be prohibited as direct aid to religious institutions. But what does indirect encompass, and why is it important that it was rejected? Well, indirect suggests that the benefit to the religious or private institution is achieved indirectly. In this case, school choice programs are provided to families, and they freely choose where they shall go or where their children shall go. And in that circumstance, you would say, most people would say, well, that's not a direct grant to a private institution and not prohibited by Alaska's Blaine Amendment. But your Supreme Court has, in fact, interpreted direct to encompass those forms of indirect assistance. And that's why this language has to go, if you want to have school choice, because the legislature, of course, can't overrule the interpretation of the state Supreme Court of a constitutional provision. And if you want school choice in Alaska, you've got to change this language. Just as the three states that I mentioned, Louisiana, Arkansas, and New Jersey, which deleted the Blaine Amendments from their state constitutions, and South Carolina, I would point out, when faced with a very similar situation to what the Sheldon Jackson case created in Alaska, amended its constitution the very next year to get rid of and indirect from its direct and indirect prohibition of aid. So basically, you know, what we have is four states that have had or amended their state constitutions in such a way that it makes them more pro-school choice. Now, one of the kind of confounding variables in this has been the relationship between state religion clauses and the federal constitution, because as some of you may be aware, we have dual sovereignty, and both constitutions apply in every state. And the Federal Establishment Clause has been a source of a lot of judicial consideration by the United States Supreme Court, and it hasn't always had a very clear outcome. It's been very confused over the years, in part because until the 1940s, nobody ever thought that the First Amendment's Establishment Clause applied to the states, because the First Amendment, as you all know, says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. It's directed at Congress because, of course, at the time the First Amendment was added to the Constitution shortly after the Revolution, some states actually had established state churches. And so it was deliberate that it was directed to Congress and not to the states, because there was a desire on the part of the states which had an established religion to preserve their establishments. Well, they've gotten rid of all of those over time, and Alaska, of course, never had one. But it was not until the 1940s the U.S. Supreme Court actually started applying the Establishment Clause against the states, and so that's when we start the development of federal jurisprudence about state programs. Well, as the U.S. Constitution was applied to these state programs, some of which are school choice type programs. State constitutions were also being considered, and you had varying degrees of willingness to reach parallel conclusions. And it was never particularly clear until fairly recently whether or not the federal constitution allowed school choice programs. Now, after 2002, with the U.S. Supreme Court finally addressing a scholarship program, the one in Cleveland, Ohio, in a case called Zelman versus Simmons-Harris, the U.S. Supreme Court has now finally clarified that, in fact, scholarship-type programs are perfectly constitutional under the Federal Establishment Clause. And so that has essentially opened the state to the possibility of having these sorts of programs and not being challenged in federal court. And so all of these cases that I mentioned where we're defending state programs, we're defending in the state courts. And so the only action is in the state courts and under the state religion clauses and these sort of state Blaine amendments. And accordingly, the federal standard serves as a floor or as a irreducible minimum for school choice in a way that it was somewhat confused up until Zelman in 2002. And so it's not as if you repeal this part of your state constitution and all of a sudden you're going to see direct grants being made to private educational institutions, including religious ones, because, quite frankly, the federal constitution does not allow direct, unrestricted grants to private religious schools or colleges. However, after Zelman, it does allow student scholarships to be provided to families where the families make a free and independent choice of where to send their children, and as long as the program in which they are making that choice is in fact a religiously neutral one. And what that means is that should you eliminate this provision from the state constitution, that the Zelman standard would be the effective legal standard in the state of Alaska, and that standard does not allow direct aid to religious schools and institutions, but it does permit aid to be provided to families. And just for one final point, I'd like to distinguish here between what I'm talking about, aid to families. Sometimes the aid to families, like federal Pell Grants, may be sent directly to a college, but it's not being sent there as institutional aid. It is not direct aid to the college. They can only apply those funds to the account of the student. And, of course, the reason we send the money directly in these programs to the school is not to benefit the school, but to benefit the family and the student, but by making sure that the money is actually used for the purpose you're giving it to the student. Because if you provided federal Pell Grants as checks to the students, everybody knows that a certain number of the students would misappropriate the money and buy a car, use it for alcohol or drugs. It wouldn't go for the intended purpose. But the fact that it's sent to the school is not what's important. What's important is that it's sent to the school for the benefit of an individual student, not as institutional aid to the school, like to build a gymnasium, but rather to satisfy the contractual obligation of the family to pay for their education from the school. And so the real intended beneficiary and actual beneficiary of the monies sent to the school in a school choice program are the students and their families.
Thank you, Mr. Comer. Thank you very much. Just for your information, you didn't get to see it, but every parent here got that part about the direct benefit to the student going through the school. So I think we got that. I'm going to have to move on here. I've got four other people, and I want to give them 20 minutes each at least. And that's about where I cut you off at, is about 20 minutes or so.
Great.
So I appreciate it. I hope that we will get to hear from you again. And if you have something written that you can submit to this committee, I would greatly appreciate that, and we'll be in touch with you on that.
Okay, thank you very much, and I'll stay on the line in case at the end anyone has questions that might be directed to me.
Greatly appreciated. So with that, I'm going to kind of move on here. I didn't realize how much fun and how fast this was going to go. Kevin, why don't you come on forward? So that was kind of one of the legal arguments that we go forward. We're going to go to kind of the experience. And so, Senator Wilkowski?
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair, did you say you were taking questions at the end of each individual speaker or at the end? In total?
Well, it's going to be running tight, but if you have a question, and you just reminded me something, I did not recognize Senator Huggins, Senator Kelly, and Representative Foster, and who else came in that I probably should have recognized. As you can see, this generates a fair amount of interest. Senator Wilkowski, did you have a question that you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a legal question, and I was just curious if private schools take public money, does that then subject those private schools to state rules, for instance, anti-discrimination provisions? Have courts ruled on that?
Mr. Comer?
Oops, I'm sorry. I started answering before I was unmuted. But first, I'd just like to mention that before I came to the Institute for Justice 20 years ago, I spent 14 years as a federal career civil rights attorney for the Office for Civil Rights in the U.S. Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, and the EEOC. So I actually enforced non-discrimination laws. And first, I'd like to note one thing, which is that there is a civil rights law that applies to all private colleges and institutions, 42 U.S.C. 1981, which already prohibits them from discriminating on the basis of race, color, or national origin. And this is a law that was passed after the Civil War and was interpreted to apply regardless of whether they accept any state dollars in Runyon versus McCrary in 1972. However, other non-discrimination requirements, generally speaking, do not flow federal ones because these programs don't use federal dollars. And so the federal civil rights strings don't attach the ones that are like Title VI, Title IX, Section 504, that only come with the acceptance of federal financial assistance. Other provisions that don't flow or tie to federal funding, like the Americans with Disabilities Act, I'm less familiar with, but those, generally speaking, I don't think are contingent on the acceptance of federal dollars. Generally speaking, the states, such as Alaska, already regulate private schools in varying degrees. I mean, states differ on this. And it really is a matter of state law as to whether or not various civil rights provisions are attached. I would note that, generally speaking, there are good reasons why we don't generally apply to private education the sorts of requirements we apply to public education, where the system is the funding recipient and where they have to take all comers. So Wellesley College, for example, is allowed to be a single-sex institution. You may recall that's where Hillary Clinton went. And she would go bananas if Title IX were applied to require Wellesley to become a co-ed institution.
And Mr. Comer? Mr. Comer?
Yes.
I'm going to stop there because you can see this could take up the whole committee meeting. And
yes,
really,
I apologize.
And, well, I mean, the question is real, relevant, and before we can pass on to the people a constitutional amendment, we will have a deep conversation about it. This is more or less an introduction to that, and so thank you. And because of the time frame, I'm going to try to limit those questions only because I think we're going to run out of time for those who came to give us their best testimony. And what we'll do from there is I will try to make sure these experts are available for the kind of questions. So with that, because I could see we could get into that discussion and spend the whole committee there. So thank you. And I just wanted to note my own representative, Tammy Wilson, over here. So she didn't wave high enough. Thank you, Kevin. Please introduce yourself, and give us your testimony. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Kevin Chavis. I'm the executive counsel for the American Federation for Children, one of the nation's leading voices of school choice. I thought I'd do a couple of things to hopefully aid the committee and the various members of this legislative branch on this issue, these branches on this issue. Is one, just share my story and how I got to be here in front of you today. That shouldn't take too long. And then talk more about the efficacies of educational choice and why it's important, and frankly why you should repeal the Blaine Amendment that I think provides a barrier to you reaching the educational goals that you feel is important for this great state. I guess to begin with, I was on the District of Columbia Council in Washington, D.C. For 12 years, from 1993 to 2005. For 8 of those years, I was chairman of the Education Committee. So in late 1996, early 1997, I really led the effort to start charter schools in D.C. At the time, I was one of the first Democrats in the country to support charter schools publicly. We have one of the most prolific and substantial charter school laws in the nation, and as a result, nearly 45% of our public school kids are in charter schools, and they're on balance far outpacing their traditional public school counterparts. And I don't say that as a way to lead into an us versus them discussion, but really to give context as to the benefit of educational choice as it relates to your nation's capital. In 2003, then Mayor Tony Williams and I worked with Education Secretary Rod Page and President Bush on a landmark federal partnership with the nation's capital. And we had what we called a three-sector strategy, where the federal government agreed to give the city $50 million each year on an annual basis, divided in three ways. A third of the money going to help D.C. public schools, our traditional school system. A third of the money going to help charter schools, particularly facilities funding. And the other third for the landmark scholarship program, or our voucher program, which provided about $7,500 in tuition assistance to children who come from the most acute poverty backgrounds in the city. And as a result of that program, I'm proud to say 10 years later, we have nearly 2,000 children who are benefiting from that program, children that otherwise would have dropped out of school, by and large, because of the demographics in the schools they previously attended. And as of today, they have 94% of those kids in the program graduate from high school. That's over 40 points higher than D.C. public schools percentages, and 89% of those children are going to college. So I'm very proud of that program, and it was through that experience that I learned the value of educational choice. Since leaving the D.C. Council in 2005, I'd like to say on my way to public life I found my passion, and I've become quite immersed in the educational reform movement and the school choice movement. As I said, I'm working with the American Federation for Children. I've been on the board of the Black Alliance for Educational Options. I was the founder and current chair of Democrats for Education Reform. I also have a regular column on Huffington Post. I've written a couple of books, but more than anything, I love America's children. And I think that we are doing them a vast disservice by not allowing them to maximize on their human potential. And in my experience, as you consider this proposal, I think context, again, is important. And there are three truisms that I have learned as a result of my years doing this work. One truism is that as a nation, 30 years after A Nation at Risk was released, that landmark report card on the state of American public education, then in effect said that our greatest threat to democracy is our failure to educate our children. Well, 30 years later, the education outputs of American school-aged children are worse than they were back then. Nearly half of the children of color in this country drop out of school. Our fourth and eighth grade scores aren't as good as they used to be, and neither are our good schools as good as they used to be. We've had historically, over the last several years, fewer AP courses. And what is most troubling, what's most troubling to the nature and notion of our democracy, is that we are virtually becoming non-competitive on a global front when compared with other industrialized nations around the world. Indeed, before I finish this sentence, a child will drop out of school in America. Nearly 7,000 children each day drop out of high school in America. That's over 1.2 million a year. And I give you those statistics not to scare you, because you understand them yourself if you looked at your own numbers. Alaska spends more per capita, as I understand it, than any other place in the country on the education of their children, and the outputs are among the worst in the country. So I come to you as we talk about or think about that one truism with this reality I put before you. There should be an immense sense of urgency to do something radical, bold, and meaningful for children. This is not the type of issue where incrementalism should be the order of the day. The second truism I've learned is that no school bureaucracy will ever reform itself from within. They never have, and they never will. The only way any school bureaucracy will reform itself is through external pressure. And the best form of external pressure that I have seen is educational choice. Indeed, I defy anyone to name any school district in America that has seen wholesale meaningful reform to benefit children where there hasn't been a robust educational choice program in existence to help provide the impetus for the reform and also provide parents with quality options they need in order to take care of those children today. The third truism is, in those cities where we have seen robust educational choice reforms take place, you've seen improvement in traditional public schools. This debunks the notion that educational choice, meaningful, well thought out, well planned educational choice programs, negatively impact traditional public schools. The opposite, in fact, has taken place. Milwaukee, which has the largest scholarship program, or the longest serving scholarship program in the country, is 20 years old. The Milwaukee Public Schools still takes care of most of the children in the city. But interestingly, from 2003 to 2009, Milwaukee Public Schools graduation rates went from 49% to 70%, largely because of the competition and the alternative options that parents were faced with. It jump-started meaningful change in Milwaukee public schools. In Florida, from 1998 to 2007, after their robust educational choice program, mainly through charter schools as well as the tax credit program, in which today 50,000 children are able to receive a quality education in private schools, their fourth grade reading scores went from 53% to 71%, largely because of the impact of educational choice. And in Louisiana, where I worked with Governor Jindal and two African-American Democrats who were the lead sponsors in the House and Senate for their New Orleans scholarship program 5 years ago, and then I worked with them last year when we made it into a statewide program. We have seen monumental change in New Orleans, and 10,000 parents rushed to sign up for these scholarships when they were made available last year. They applied for the scholarships. In Indiana, where you also have a statewide scholarship program, we have seen something that, frankly, I had never seen before. After they passed the program, Indianapolis Public Schools, one of the worst performing school districts in America, took out advertisements to remind parents that they could educate their children too. At the end of the day, educational choice provides the impetus for reforms that otherwise wouldn't take place. And when I talk about sense of urgency, I mean, well, let me put it like this. I mean, we've got to figure out a way to fly the plane at the same time as we fix it. Many of the things that you will labor over the next several years regarding wholesale systemic reform, better accountability, better autonomy, should there be Common Core? How can we get a quality teacher in the classroom? What's the right curriculum? Those things take time. And you know what? When you hire that new superintendent and that reform plan du jour that that new superintendent puts in place, where they always say, give us 3 to 5 years, that's the fix-it part of the plane. But the flying part means we've got to do something today to stem the tide of challenges that we see with the deficits our children are facing. That's what educational choice does. That's why parents are flocking around this idea of charter schools and virtual schools and home schools and specialty schools and magnet schools. All forms of parental choice give parents what they need today so we can fly the plane at the same time as we fix it. And then one final thing. I proudly am a Democrat. But more than that, I am more proudly an American citizen. And there is absolutely, without question, no Republican or Democrat way to teach a kid how to read, write, count, or compete. Our biggest barrier to change is not just putting quality teachers in classrooms to help children do those things. Our biggest barrier to change is the partisanship that we have allowed to creep into the issue of deciding what's best for children. So at the end of the day, the yardstick that I use, which I would urge you to consider using, with all due respect, when I decided to embark on the notion of doing what's best for children, is to frankly do just that. The simple yardstick, the ruler, the guide that I employed was this. Will this proposal help a child or group of children learn? If the answer is yes, I'm for it. If it's no, I'm against it. And I don't care whether it's a Republican proposal, a Democratic proposal, or an independent proposal. The deficits we're facing in this country are too stark, and the future of our democracy is too precious for us to be overburdened by the partisanship of the day when it comes to the education of our children. Thank you all very much, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's Chavis, right?
Chavis.
I got to practice that. First of all, thank you for coming to the committee. Thank you for coming to Alaska for the challenge you put before us and the experience that you brought. So I think for me, my sentiments fall right in along line with you. So I greatly appreciate it. We have been joined by Senator Bishop. So thank you very much. Is there questions for Mr. Chavis? Yes, Senator Gardner.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Your presentation is very interesting, as you can tell by the number of legislators who showed up. You're speaking a lot about, you spoke about charter schools, specialty schools, magnet schools, home schools, correspondence. Alaska offers all of those already, charter schools. And I I just sort of like to clarify sort of terminology, because we do have charter schools that are here, and they take a different kind of functioning, because they really require the community to create them through with working with the school district, but it requires leadership that comes from the ground. The school district can't sort of create it without having a guiding members of the public, usually parents, sometimes teachers. Can you speak to that?
I'm well aware of your charter schools, and they, as I understand it, they are many are authorized through the district, and I think that's great. But I do think that this issue is the social justice issue of our time, and we don't put any limits or lids on social justice, and we shouldn't put limits or lids on the type of quality options we offer for kids. And I think if there are opportunities to put some of these children in robust, meaningful, and beneficial private schools that work for them, let's do it. When I say, again, by any means necessary, I mean that. One thing that the technology explosion has taught us or shown us is that, and if you have more than one child, you know this intuitively, children respond to different learning modalities. And we should be a laboratory of opportunity for children to give them as many of these modalities as possible. And that shouldn't be trumped by adult interests, no matter whose adult interests they are. So, I mean, I understand your point. Yes, you do have some of these options. Let's have them all.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you or your organization, the American Federation of Children, believe that we'd be better off just simply privatizing our school systems completely and just giving parents a check to educate them as they educating their kids as they please?
No, because I don't think any organization should dictate what a parent's choice should be. I mean, I think that in some places, and we've seen this, you know, it's beneficial for all the parents to have all their kids in the traditional public school if there's innovation and creativity at work in that district. But we're talking about situations where we know that 30, 40, or 50% of the schools are failing. So, no, at American Federation of Children, we're not advocating one means or modality of education over another. But what we're saying is, let's give parents as many of these options as possible and let them choose. And you know what? It works. Because when they choose, then it helps make everyone more attentive to what the ultimate goal is. We need to provide a quality education service for these parents and these kids, or they're not going to bring their kids to our school.
Senator Dunleavy has a question as well. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm not sure if I heard you mention privatization. I can't recall that you did.
No, I did not.
Just a question. In your travels and in your work and trying to put children first, truly put children first, not just say put children first, but put children first. Who, from your experience, who, as we go down this route, because there's been a resolution introduced in both bodies now, who or what groups would be against something like this?
Well, look, I think that, you know, traditionally in a lot of these places, the opposition is the traditional educational establishment, whatever form that needs to be. You know, I don't think we should look at it as an either or zero sum game. This is not the type of thing where we're going to bash this group or that group. I mean, I think our charge is to elevate the discussion. And in elevating the discussion, I mean, I've had representatives in other places tell me, I can't support this because even if it helps our children or helps the children in my district, I had a representative say to me, I can't support this because that person over there supports it, and they're on the other side of the political spectrum. And I said, with all due respect, if that's your reason, maybe you shouldn't be here. Because at the end of the day, we shouldn't be caught in the petty partisanship or the petty politics that we have a host of issues we can go down that road with. I mean, I think at the end of the day, elevating the discussion really means just that our fiduciary responsibility as stewards of the state who are safeguarding the interests of these children should predominate over everything else.
Thank you. That is an excellent point. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there public school systems in low-income areas in the United States that work without charter schools? And is there anything without this school voucher system? And are there things that you think we can learn from them? Or do you think this is the only solution out there is to go to a voucher system?
Again, you say only. I don't say only solution. But what I do say is you have to have a host of solutions available for parents to choose that will work. And you raise an interesting point. Former Education Secretary Bill Bennett made a statement on TV that I saw last month that caused me to think and do a little bit of research. So thank you for the question. He said he didn't know of any urban school district that is working for children, where you could say 80-90% of the kids are proficient. And you know what? I think he's right. If anyone knows, let me know. Because at the end of the day, we do have some incremental success, but because we have dumbed down our view of what success means, superintendents get contracts renewed, with all due respect to anyone may hear, I don't know, but superintendents get contract renewed if they can show 5 to 7 percentage point increase, percentage point increase. See, my view is, if you've got 65% of the school of the children in your school district proficient, that's not success. And I think we're hard pressed to find an urban school district that can boast 65 or 70%. Now, when you start talking about 90-95% proficient, and proficient means basic reading at grade level, basic math at grade level. So when we talk about getting in the 90s, then we can pat ourselves on the back and say that we're doing something right in education in America.
Senator McGuire, you have one then, Senator Dyson.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for flying all this way and for your commitment to children and public service before that. I am this close to you, so I can feel your – no, it's wonderful. I can feel your sincerity and passion and I just appreciate it when people are willing to get on a plane and cross borders to share their experiences. So
during the winter, right?
That's right, and during the winter. So you can tell people you've been to Alaska in the winter, which is very different. A couple of things I want to say. First of all, I have heard the school choice movement referred to as the civil rights movement of modern-day America. And I think it's an interesting thing, the way that you describe it. You've come as close to that. As I have heard, besides reading that article, that, you know, when you're standing up for children and their rights, it's their opportunity, irrespective of race, irrespective of financial background, who they're born to, and so on, that they get that opportunity, that shot. And I'm moved by that. And so I'm going to say just a couple more remarks and then ask my question. It strikes me that many of my neighbors who put their children in private school here in the state of Alaska do so because they have the means to do so and continue to pay property tax, which goes toward a publicly funded school system. And yet next to them might be another neighbor who doesn't have those same means. So they pay the property taxes, but they may want to choose to send their child to a private school, but they don't have that opportunity. And so therein lies what I would deem to be that civil rights movement underpinning. So if that's the case, then I'm all for something like that. What I get concerned about on the other side that it has been advocated to me from my friends who are teachers, some of whom I grew up with and who I value tremendously their dedication. And I want to be clear that my remarks are not against anybody in the public school system here in the state of Alaska. Great teachers, great principals, great charter schools, and so on. But we're talking about an issue here. But that said, that some of the concerns that they have and others is that we have limited funding as it is. And in a state that's funded 90% by oil revenues and in a decline mode and trying to talk about how we're going to spread those resources out, what would happen if you were able to allocate that individual resource to every family unit and allow them to vote with their feet if they voted to choose private schools in a way that allowed the public school system to deteriorate to a point where now then the ultimate goal of making sure that women, Alaska Natives, people of color, white, everybody, men, women, all backgrounds, then didn't have that opportunity necessarily to get into a healthy education system. And so I just ask, you made reference to the fact that that was a truism, that in places where that was thought to be a concern, that the minute you entered the voucher system, that the public school system would degrade and fall apart, and yet that's not been the case. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, experience has been our best teacher. I mean, one of the things that opponents of expanded choice say is that very thing, that, you know, they'll be cherry-picking, or you'll leave just the uninformed parents, or you'll drain the system of talented kids. You'll ruin public education. Well, again, just look at where there have been these programs. In fact, in Louisiana, the New Orleans program, the state comptroller showed not only are the kids doing better who are in the scholarship program, but showed the savings that inured to the state because the voucher amount was less than the per pupil allotment for children. So the state actually got savings, and the kids were being educated. But on top of that, over the last three decades, we've increased education funding in America threefold. And since the charter movement started 20 years ago, those education increases haven't stopped. And every traditional, and now, like you deal with it in this state, just about every state legislature knows that one of their biggest pieces of the financial pie is education funding. It wasn't like that 30 years ago. And even with the advent of more choice in charter programs, you still see increased funding. And you see savings as a result of those programs, because they're oftentimes doing more of less. So I don't think that experience shows us that there will be a mad rush to these other programs. But what will happen, it will help really put the external pressure on the system to do what they have been saying they want to do. And don't get me wrong, as opposed to educational choice being the ruination of traditional public schools, as we've seen in places like Florida and Milwaukee, it may have been the salvation. Because it you know, now Milwaukee public schools can talk about their graduation rates like the charter schools and the private schools. They couldn't do that 20 years ago.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson has a question, then Representative Ledoux, and I think after that we're going to have to move on.
My question was answered.
All right. So, Representative Ledoux.
Thank you for your excellent presentation. I just have one question for you. I agree with you that I don't think you're going to see masses of people exit the public schools. So my question and my concern is this. Right now, you have a significant number of people who are able to choose to send their children to private school. And so in this era of where we're trying to, you know, tighten our belts and avoid, you know, fiscal conflagration, aren't we going to be spending a significant amount of money subsidizing children and subsidizing parents who are already in the private schools?
Well, you know, states deal with that differently. That's a great question. I mean, in some of the states where we have these scholarship voucher programs, you know, one of the prerequisites is you can't already have been in a private school. You have to be actually coming from the public school system, particularly, you know, a school that may have been failed or something like that. I mean, there are different states have wanted to address that issue by making sure that they didn't subsidize folks who already had exercise choice. And then the biggest safeguard to the public money that we have seen is making sure they're means tested. and that these that you have children from the most challenged economic households are the first ones to avail themselves of these kind of programs.
Can I just have one?
Very briefly, we now have run into putting the other people in a pressure where they may not be able to present adequately. So, quickly.
Really quickly. So, you're not advocating then a choice program which would encompass choice for everyone in the state. You'd just limit it to means testing or specific failing schools? Is that
Well, I don't like the failing schools model at all. And you know why I don't like failing schools? We've tried that. Because, you know, a lot of times the educational establishment will play with the numbers. What could be failing one? I'll give you an example. In Cleveland, they had Washington, and I can't remember the exact names, Washington High was failing, Lincoln High was failing. They merged them into Jefferson High, and they weren't failing anymore. I mean, so, you know, they play all kind of games with the failing schools model, so that really is not a good model. But I do think means testing is probably preferable.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I really appreciate it. We have run pretty close to time, but as you can see, on each one of these presenters could take the whole committee if we wish to do that. And it's a question that we want to ask ourselves in Alaska, and certainly it has been presented to the legislature. Thank you very much, Kevin. We have Patrick Wolf on the line, and he is going to talk to us about common myths, and then we'll go to Ben Scafidi on fiscal impacts is, I think, how we'll do that. So, Patrick, are you able to hear us?
Yes, I can.
We can barely hear you, so we'll try that one more time.
Okay, I'll bring the phone a little closer. Is that better?
That is excellent. Thank you. Identify yourself. Give us a little bit of your background, and then chime in.
Okay, sure. My name is Patrick Wolf, and I'm pleased to be with you today to share my expertise regarding the effects of private school choice programs. I did get a chance to visit your great state in November of 2011 to speak at Mayor Sullivan's Anchorage Education Summit. So I certainly can picture the beautiful snow-capped mountains that surround you right now, even while I'm down here in Arkansas. I am a professor of education policy and the endowed chair in school choice at the University of Arkansas. I also am a consultant to the U.S. Department of Education regarding the design and implementation of rigorous evaluations of education programs. I want to make it clear that today I'm speaking to you in my capacity as a scholar. The opinions that I share with you do not necessarily represent any official positions of the Obama administration, the U.S. Department of Education, or the University of Arkansas. This is just from me. Now, today, there are 31 private school choice programs funded by direct government appropriations or tax credits that serve 245,000 children nationally. I've spent the last 14 years studying such programs, especially the school voucher programs in Milwaukee and the District of Columbia. Last year, my research team released the final reports from our longitudinal evaluation of the nation's first school voucher program, the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. Established in 1990, the Choice Program enrolled 25,000 students in 113 private schools of their parents' choosing in 2012. Through careful scientific analysis, we were able to determine that the students in the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program outgained similar Milwaukee public school students in reading over a four-year period, though achievement gains for the two groups were similar in math. Importantly, we also confirmed that choice students outperform public school students in educational attainment. Just as educational achievement is a measure of how much you know in school, educational attainment is a measure of how far you go in school. It is commonly measured by important benchmarks such as high school graduation, college enrollment, and persistence in college. The students in the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program attained all of these important benchmarks at rates that were 4 to 7 percentage points higher than comparable Milwaukee public school students. The public school students in our Milwaukee study enrolled in college at the rate of 25%. So the fact that the choice students attended college at the higher rate of 30% represents a 20% increase in college enrollment rates for low-income Milwaukee students due to the choice program. These higher educational attainment rates for choice students are important because young people who go farther in school do better in life. students who graduate from high school live longer, earn more money during their lifetime, and are less likely ever to be divorced, unemployed, or incarcerated than students who do not graduate. Through the course of our study, we also determined that the choice program generated competitive pressure on Milwaukee public schools that led to increases in student achievement, even for the public school students who never participated in the program. This is similar to what Kevin Chavis commented on earlier. School choice in Milwaukee generated a rising tide that lifted all boats. What is perhaps most amazing about the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program is that it produced all of these positive outcomes: higher reading scores and graduation rates for choice students, and higher achievement scores for public school students, while saving Wisconsin taxpayers' money. The maximum amount of the Milwaukee voucher has hovered around $6,500 for the past 5 years, a period during which the average amount spent on each Milwaukee public school student surged from $12,000 to $15,000. Because the value of the private school voucher in Milwaukee is so much less than public per pupil spending in the public schools, my research team was able to determine that the operation of the Choice Program saves Wisconsin taxpayers over $52 million per year. So our final verdict on the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program is that it produced better outcomes for students at lower cost to the state. Such encouraging results are common when researchers use scientific methods to evaluate school voucher programs. The generally positive effects of private school choice are similar for both government-financed voucher programs and tax credit-financed scholarship programs. As reported in Education Week last year, of the 10 gold standard experimental evaluations of voucher and voucher-type programs, 9 have reported achievement gains from the voucher programs for all or some subgroups of participating students. For example, in an evaluation of the DC Opportunity Scholarship Program that I led for the U.S. Department of Education, we found that after 3 years, students who used the federally sponsored vouchers gained an additional 4.5 months of learning compared to students in the control group. The DC Choice students also graduated from high school at much higher rates than control group students. As Kevin Chavis mentioned, the impact of using a DC school voucher was to increase the likelihood of a student graduating from high school by 21 percentage points, from 70% to 91%. That represents a 30% gain in the high school graduation rate for a highly disadvantaged group of students. David Figlio of Northwestern University is conducting a rigorous longitudinal evaluation of the Florida statewide tax credit scholarship program, which helps over 50,000 low-income students enroll in private schools. He has found that the school choice program has produced a statistically significant increase in the reading achievement of participating students. Although math achievement also is higher among the students exercising school choice in Florida, that difference is not quite statistically significant at normal confidence levels. In Milwaukee, D.C., and Florida, we see very similar findings that private school choice increases student reading scores. No rigorous study of private school choice programs has ever found that they harm students academically. Moreover, study after study of both voucher and tax credit scholarship programs have shown that public schools deliver better educational results for their students when they face competition from private school choice. Of 20 rigorous studies of the competitive effects of private school choice on public school performance, 19 of them document that competition led to an increase in student performance. Another finding that is absolutely undeniable is that private school choice programs serve highly disadvantaged students because they are designed to do so. Of the 31 voucher and tax credit scholarship programs in the U.S., 18 are means tested so that they serve lower income families. A total of 6 programs are limited to students in underperforming public schools. 2 programs in New Orleans and the state of Ohio are doubly targeted specifically to low income students in poor performing public schools. 9 voucher programs are limited exclusively to students with disabilities. These special needs voucher programs enroll over 14% of all school voucher users. Let's take a quick look at the students who participated in the DC voucher program beginning in 2004. Over 99% of them were African American or Hispanic American. Their average annual family income was just over $17,000. In Arkansas, we call that dirt poor. Only 6% of the mothers of participating students had college degrees. over 17% of the participating students had a diagnosed disability. The students served by this federal school choice program were highly disadvantaged. At the start of our Milwaukee study in 2006, we had to match up the voucher students in our panel with a lower performing segment of public school students because the voucher children were so much more disadvantaged than their public school peers. As my colleague John Witte likes to say, and I'm quoting here, the evidence is overwhelming that voucher programs do not cream the best and the brightest kids. In fact, it is the opposite. They attract more disadvantaged students out of public schools. Researchers also have examined the effect of school vouchers or private schooling on civic values, such as racial integration, political tolerance, and volunteerism. The voucher programs that have operated in major cities have either improved the racial integration of schools or have had no effect on integration, positive or negative. Such programs often improve racial integration because they allow minority students to leave overwhelmingly minority public schools for private schools with fewer minorities. Studies of the effect of private schooling on political tolerance similarly tend to report either positive effects or no net effect. Research has confirmed that students and adults volunteer in their communities at higher rates if they have exercised private school choice. One of the strongest positive impacts of school choice programs is on parent satisfaction with schools. Every study that has asked the question has found that parents are much happier with their child's school if they played a role in choosing it. In my DC study, we found that 80% of voucher parents graded their child's school A or B, compared to just 50% of the parents of control group students. In sum, private school choice programs disproportionately serve disadvantaged students. They deliver a variety of educational benefits to them under most circumstances. They spur affected public schools to improve. Parents absolutely love them. They tend to enhance and not undermine the public purposes of education, and they deliver education more efficiently. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can throw impressive school choice statistics at you all afternoon, but to get a clear idea of what a voucher program does for families, we also conducted focus groups with parents and older students participating in the school choice programs we evaluated. I will conclude with a quote from a parent of a student in the DC voucher program, explaining why the program was important to her. Quote, "When my son dressed in that uniform with that green blazer, the white shirt, tie, gray trousers, and he looked like a gentleman and a scholar, and he had his hair cut and his glasses, and he was just grinning from ear to ear, that he was going to be a part of that private school culture. And he went to school that day, and he was excited about going to school." Mr. Chairman, this concludes my formal testimony. I welcome questions from the committee.
Thank you very much. I have time for one question, so otherwise I'm going to cut my next presenter way, way short. So I'm sorry to have to do that, but Senator Gardner, I'm sorry to...
Thank you, especially considering I'm the one gets the question. You've talked about some specific programs that you've studied, but a quick internet search also has information about charter schools that haven't done very well, and particularly I think the for-profit programs. Can you speak to maybe the differences, or have you ever studied success of a for-profit, of a voucher program that's operated by for-profit organizations?
Mr. Chairman and legislator, basically all of the private schools participating in school voucher programs are not-for-profit organizations. That's basically the form that private schooling takes at the K-12 level is not-for-profit. Now, I think you were referring to a public charter school study, where some of the charter school management organizations that ran the public charter schools were for-profit. Although I'm somewhat familiar with those studies, my expertise is really on private school choice through voucher programs, so I'm not going to speak specifically to that issue.
Thank you. And this really kicks open quite a discussion, so Mr. Wolf, I sure appreciate it, and I'm sorry that we, once again, probably could have taken the whole session on this. But I did want to bring, and thank you very much. I hope that you had some things written that you can get to the committee. I will make sure that we get back with you on that. Thank you. And next we have Ben, and I hope I can say this right. It's Scafidi. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, hi. This is actually Robert Emlo. I'm the president and CEO of the Friedman Foundation. Dr. Scafidi is testifying in Georgia and should be joining us hopefully in a moment.
Okay.
I was going to give most of his presentation, if that is okay with you, sir.
Mr. Enlow, please proceed. We've got only about 14 minutes left, and I'm sorry to have to say that.
No, I apologize, and we'll try and run through this quickly. I think Dr. Scafidi has given a presentation to everyone, a document that you can go over. Unfortunately, this is the nuts and bolts of school choice and education, because it's about the dollars, and I think it's important when we start to always remember the child that Dr. Wolf mentioned who wanted to get a good education. So if you look at the roadmap of what I want to talk about, let's take a look quickly at the staffing in our traditional school systems and what's happening, and what does school choice harm our state budgets, and then does school choice harm budgets of local school districts. So on slide number 3, if you look at the growth in the students and the public school personnel in the United States from fiscal year 1950 to 2009, you see that our student growth was 96%, but our total school personnel growth was 386%. If you actually break that down to teachers and administrators, you're looking at a significant increase in administrators over students, 96% increase in students, but a 702% increase in administrators and other staff. If you look at that on slide 4, from the 1992 to 2009, that same trend is continuing, right? So we had a 17% increase in the United States and more than double then of total personnel increase. So it's basically since 1950, you've seen dramatic increases in personnel and particularly administrative personnel as opposed to students. Now, a couple notes about that, if you can look at on slide 5. You know, during the same time of 1970 to 2009, student achievement didn't really rise. It remained flat and in some instances got worse. There's no evidence that our kids are performing worse in any shape, manner, or form. And No Child Left Behind did not make us increase our administrators in this country as much as we have. A lot of that was, of course, done well before No Child Left Behind. The simple fact is that American traditional public schools are more top-heavy than any other wealthy nations. So then the question is, well, what about Alaska? So if you look at some of the basic numbers from the 2010 Digest of Education Statistics, so the student-teacher ratio in Alaska is slightly higher than the U.S. average, so it's 1 to 16.5 versus 15.3 in the United States. Then if you look at the ratio, however, of students to administrators and other non-teaching staff, you see a different story. So Alaska has a 14.2 ratio compared to the United States, which has a 15.9 ratio. Again, thinking about how many administrators and non-teaching staff there are more. Then if you look at the ratio of students to public school employees, again, you have a ratio that's roughly comparable with the United States on slide 9. But I think if you then go to slide 10, which is, I think, the slide that is important, you know, we showed about the slide relating to the U.S. growth in students versus personnel, look at the Alaskan growth from 1992 to 2009. So you've seen a 10% increase in students, but a 23% increase in total school personnel. If you look at that in terms of teachers and administrators, you've roughly been on par with teachers, so a 10% increase in students, an 11% increase in teachers, but a 300% increase in the number of administrators and personnel. So a 10% increase in students versus a 34% increase in administrators and other staff. Now, the question is, as you'll see, between fiscal year 1992 and 2009, Alaska public schools hired administrators and other non-teaching staff at a rate that's almost 3.5 times as their increases in the number of students and teachers. Now, the question to ask, I think, one of ourselves before we talk about school choice is, what could have happened if Alaska had increased its non-teaching staff at the same rate as its increase in students? So you increase in 10% of students and you increase its non-teaching staff at the same rate. Well, if you look at the data, Dr. Scafidi has found that you actually would have saved Alaska public schools about $66 million per year in savings. Now, what could Alaska do with $66 million per year? Well, you could spend more than $12,000 per classroom for 25 students. You could give every Alaska teacher an $8,400 raise. You could reduce state and local taxes, or you could offer children scholarships to private schools. The point here is that Alaska, like most of America, is among the top heavy states. America is among the top heavy countries. We have more administrators and non-teaching staff than we could have saved ourselves a lot of money. So it's important to mention that when you look at what the fiscal effect of school choice is on local and state budgets. Now, the first thing that you need to think about is it's really quite straightforward to design any school choice program that saves the state's money. Remember, we already shift dollars in most states, and I'm assuming Alaska is much the same, when children transfer from one public school to another public school. The money generally follows the child based on the school funding formula. Well, the way to make and ensure that is saving money, if you include private schools, is you make sure that the state funds that follow a child is less than the average state spending per student. So if you do that, then there is simply no way that the fiscal effects of school choice can be anything but positive and beneficial to both the state, the taxpayers, and the students. So when you look about the question, though, is when some students leave, there is this question that you hear, this myth that the public schools and the traditional schools who remain behind will be harmed. Well, you've heard, of course, from Dr. Wolf before me and from my friend Kevin Chavis before me, that they are not harmed academically, and they actually are a benefit academically. But do they have fewer resources available for their education? Now, it's interesting. One thing I'd like to say about that is, you know, when we talk about the idea of if a child leaves a traditional school to go to a non-public school, you hear the argument that, well, if that child leaves, I still have to hire a teacher. I still have to turn the lights on. I still have to hire the janitorial services. Because the concept is that every cost in our traditional schools is a fixed cost. The reality, however, doesn't seem to work in reverse. Have you ever heard a traditional school district argue that when they get another child, they don't need to add more teachers, administrators, and school personnel? Because if every cost is a fixed cost, then you don't actually need to increase money to traditional schools if they increase enrollment. The reality is we have in this country and in your state a simple way to make sure schools say school choice programs save money, and that is to make sure it's less than the average cost.
Robert, just to let you know, Ben is on the line now.
Oh, good. Then he could do much better than myself at this part of the local and state budget, so I will turn it over to him.
Ben, are you on?
Thank you, Robert, and I apologize for being late, distinguished member of the committee. You know, costs are either fixed or variable, and as Robert said, it can't be that they're all fixed, because if that was the case, you wouldn't give them money when they added students. And if you look at slide 20, the federal government puts all school costs into these buckets, capital, interest, administration, you know, instruction, et cetera. So I did a study for Robert about how do you decide which of these costs are fixed or variable. So I looked at four school districts in Georgia that lost students from one year to the next for non-school choice reasons. You know, kids move out of state, kids switch to private school or homeschool or a charter school. No charter schools in these districts at this time. But, you know, kids leave districts for many reasons. You know, dad gets transferred, what have you. So I found that when those districts lost students, they were able to reduce instructional costs. If you look at slide 22, instructional costs, student support costs, instructional staff support, enterprise operations, and food service, they were able to lower those costs commensurate or more than commensurate than their loss in students. So, for example, if they lost 6% of the students, they were able to cut more than 6% of the costs in these areas. And student achievement did not go down. So some costs in public schools are variable. And so I'm arguing on slide 22 that money that follows the child, that is less than these variable costs, improve the finances of school districts, even in the very short run. I did this calculation for every state, including Alaska. And if you look at slide 23, I believe, Alaska spends almost $18,000 per student with the most recent data available to me. That's a lot above the national average. So of that $18,000 per student, I estimate that 61.9% of these costs are variable costs, even in the very short run, because they come from those categories that other school districts have been able to reduce when students left and didn't harm student achievement. And that comes to $11,140. The other $6,800 per student are fixed costs in the short run that you might want to let school districts retain when they lose students via school choice. But let me make two final points. What other enterprise in the United States do you get to get paid for students or for customers that you no longer serve? So I'm arguing let them keep some of the money for customers they no longer serve in the short run, but in the long run, all costs are variable because school districts, like any enterprise, can make different strategic decisions when they know what their enrollment patterns are going to be in the long run. But in the short run, you can give, for example, $11,000 of the money can follow the child, and you'll actually be improving the finances of school districts. And the students who remain in public school would actually have more money spent on their education. And again, I apologize for being late.
Ben and Robert, you did an excellent job of tag-teaming through 26 slides in 9 minutes. So I would say very well done. And it really gave the kind of the overview on some of the fundamental economics and the variables very well. I did not have that perspective to date, so very helpful to me. I'll make sure that every member of the committee gets a copy of these slides and any contact information. This is not the end of the discussion. The question that we're going to put before Alaskans is, should we amend our Constitution so we can enter into this discussion? So we're not going to establish necessarily the choice until we can get the permission from the people of Alaska, but surely appreciate you coming before us, both Robert and Ben. With that, is there any questions? You have 2 whole minutes before we have to anything from the committee. Yes, Gabrielle Ledoux, Representative Ledoux, has a question.
Is Mr. Comer still on the line?
I do not know. Is
yes, I'm still here.
Thank you, Mr. Comer.
Okay, so this is my question, Mr. Comer. If our state constitution does not allow any funding to private or religious organizations, I don't know whether you're familiar with the Alaska State Student Loan Program or the Alaska Performance Scholarship. And if you are, could you tell me how those things square with the constitutional prohibition?
Those are probably prohibited, but it just so happens that in the legal world, unless something gets challenged, sometimes people just go right ahead. But I think that those programs are definitely of constitutionally suspect under the Sheldon Jackson College case.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all who testified today. Very good testimony. Very well done. Very concise. Thank you very much. Thank you, committee members of all four committees. We will call this adjourned.